is The Unseen, and I'm your host, Mike Cleland. In this episode, we will be exploring the realm of the synchromystics with Alan Abadasa Green. Alan runs a website focused on synchronicity called The Sync Book, where he has logged a wealth of videos, podcasts, and articles. Along with a crew of other synchromystics, they've put together a remarkable resource to explore and archive the mysteries of synchronicity. Alan edited two big books titled The Sync Book 1 and The Sync Book 2, and these are collections of essays from a wide range of the leading thinkers on the subject of synchronicity. Starting a bit over a decade ago, a group of young thinkers emerged on the internet, and they were playing with the ideas of synchronicity and how it ties into both the lowest aspects of kitschy pop culture and the highest expressions of spiritual faith. And it is the collision of these two, the tawdry and the sacred, that just really inspires me. And Alan was at the forefront of this revolution in magical thinking. During our talk, I reference a podcast that Alan and I had done back in 2011. And this talk here is, in a way, a continuation of that amazing conversation from almost 8 years ago. This conversation was recorded on Monday, November 4th, 2009. Please enjoy. Alan, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Thank you, Mike. It means a lot to me that you asked me to do this again, and it's great to hear your voice again.
Yeah. Just so folks know, Alan and I did a wonderful podcast on my other thing, which has been dormant now for some years, and it was a remarkable conversation, and I have been wanting to talk to him again in this formal setting. A big part of my research and a huge part of his research focus on synchronicities. And there's a term that I love, synchromystical. So someone who is immersed in synchronicity, and that means experiencing synchronicity, could be called a synchromystic, which is a term I think is so beautiful. And I think Jake Kotze came up with that, didn't he?
He did indeed, yeah. And I know that term has had different meanings for him and for some of the people who've identified with it over the years, but the term itself still seems, even as the meanings maybe shift, it's a fantastic term that it's irresistible to use. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really perfect. And so you have been studying, writing, and podcasting about synchronicity for dang near a decade. Is that right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Make me feel old, but yeah. It's the time. I cannot believe how this time is passing. Yes, absolutely. It's been, oh God, like focusing on sync. Yeah. It's 2009. Yeah.
That's a decade. Yeah. That's a decade.
That is a decade. Yeah.
So, and I'm going to say this. So synchronicity is something that's always been around, right? So synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence, a coincidence that is meaningful to the observer. And I've written tons about it, and I know you've written tons about it, and you've published. Is the Sync book, is that a trilogy, or is there just two books?
There's just two books. It was intended to be a trilogy, and we'll say as of yet has not happened.
Okay, well, there's always the future. So so those books are remarkable because you're putting together really disparate authors who are, I don't know how to say this, anyone who's in this community has got a sense of humor, let me put it that way, and can be pretty like forceful in their opinions. And so the books are a dream to read. They're just wonderful because everyone gets on their high horse in totally different ways in those books, which I think is great. Here, go ahead.
Yourself included, you're in the second book, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so just go ahead and share with the audience the genesis of those books and how they might be able to get them. Because I think those are really remarkable as far as collections.
Well, so I guess it was the first book came out in 2011. And I think that was just, it grew out of that time period where blogs were so active. And I know you just sort of went through a phase of going back and looking at your blog and doing a sort of collection from that, it's kind of a similar sort of thought at the moment where I found myself hopping around from blog to blog every few days, checking in to see new articles, new content from these people who are exploring synchronicity, focused in that synchromystic genre. And I just found myself so taken by their work, everyone's sort of different flavor or spin on things. And I really wanted to get the information out there. I didn't feel it was my place to write some sort of book saying this is what I think synchronicity means. What I really wanted was maybe, since it's synchronicity is so often personal, if we had this cross-section where you had 26 different people saying this is what synchronicity means to me, the truth might lie somewhere in the middle there, you know? And I just reached out, asked everyone to write a chapter, either giving what they thought it meant or a great example or any number of ways they wanted to approach that subject. And we collected these 26 different essays. The first book was a surprising success. It's something I remain incredibly proud of. I think everyone involved with those books should be incredibly proud of those. We did a second volume, which you have a chapter in, and again, 26 other essays in that second book. And they just stand as these testaments for particularly me trying to make room for different thoughts, competing arguments and perspectives on this phenomenon.
So that's a total of 52 separate viewpoints.
Correct. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I guess I must have known that, but that's a lot. That's a lot. And I recognize that, I guess, how to say this, like synchronicity has been part of, like, Carl Jung certainly studied synchronicity and Joseph Campbell. And then the advent of the internet, it feels like, and I've written this about this, that the internet seems to have like supercharged synchronicities. I think we're like in a new realm of human communication where we've got this web of synaptic neurons that connects every Wi-Fi router and every laptop and every phone to nearly every person on the planet. I mean, it's cheating, right? You want to put in like talking horse shoelaces. You could put that into Google and figure out like, oh my God, look at all these connections. So that's not very valuable. But I think that like the energetic power of the internet has kind of supercharged synchronicity. And maybe I'm just talking from my own experience, because that's when I started writing about my own synchronicities, was in 2009 at the dawn of like what would be the blogging era, really. I guess it was started a few years earlier, but not much earlier.
I'm with you. I do think the internet has... Okay, so I'm of the mindset that what is synchronicity is a coincidence, means events are coinciding. Carl Jung says it's acausal, meaning it's not necessarily a cause and effect. It just means these two things are happening at the same time, and that is meaningful in some way, right? So in that respect, I am careful to not try and say the internet is the cause of it per se. But damn, if it's not right there alongside it. I mean, we see this unfolding of history is certainly changing. We did enter a new epoch, you know, or a new sort of age, and we can think of this as the internet age, as the information age. But there's something more to it. There are big changes taking place. And particularly with these 20 years of sort of context of looking back over this period, you see how this happens. And I just want to say, as far as your internet synchronicity, I agree it's become very hard to sort of discern what is the algorithm. You know, if I see if you and I are talking about horseshoe aces, and then tomorrow I or in 20 minutes, I look on my phone and suddenly I have an advertisement for horseshoe aces, I'm less likely to think that's a synchronicity and more likely to think my phone is spying on me, the algorithm is trying to sell me something. We do live in that age where it's become an ongoing joke amongst everybody you can speak to, even people who are nowhere near high weirdness. Everyone knows, oh, weird, I was just talking about that and now I'm getting an ad for it. Or what's even weirder, I was thinking about it. I didn't say it out loud. I didn't Google anything, but I was thinking about this thing and now I have an ad for it. Is that a synchronicity? Is that, you know, we're in a really weird time period as far as that conversation goes. But when you step outside that digital world and you have these incredibly personal synchronicities that cannot be programmed by some Facebook advertising algorithm, that are undeniable, only your innermost personal thoughts happening around you. Synchronicity once you're aware of it, particularly if you're exploring it and spending any time, it's a sort of phenomenon that I do feel like once you are paying attention to it, it starts to pay attention to you. Just like I know I've heard you talk about ufology in the same way of you start to pay attention to this and suddenly it looks back at you and says, oh, hey, welcome. You know,
yeah, the universe is a giant mirror, basically, like, you know, yeah, reflecting right back at you, whatever you project into it. So be careful what you project, I guess, is the lesson of that would be. Here's a big, big question. How has your ideas of reality, like the fabric of reality, how has that changed because of your research into synchronicity?
Well, I'm forced to exist in the material world, just as we all are. Telling you earlier, I mean, my day job is as a bartender. I have to talk to people about the most banal things regularly. I see, you know, my money come in, money go out for bills. I have a very, there is a very tangible physical just day-to-day thing that is just as real as anything else. But synchronicity has shown me there is this glittering magic happening behind the scenes that it would be very easy to ignore in that day-to-day worrying about just the BS that we have to deal with. It's so easy to ignore. I find myself from time to time, some crazy synchronicity will happen in a work setting and I'll point to one of my coworkers and say, hey, isn't that weird? And usually they're like, huh, yeah, that's really weird. And just go, you know, like sometimes they might pause for 20 seconds, but that's about it. Most people aren't thinking in those terms. Most people aren't even stopping to realize it. But if you point it out to them, usually it's shocking. Again, for guys like us, where you start to pay attention to it all the time and you are very aware of its existence and you're noticing it's so bizarre, you know, even after years of dealing with synchronicity, those types of events are so bizarre. It's like a slap in the face. It's like every time I start to view synchronicity as humdrum of like, well, you know, that's just the way it is. That's reality. It's just an even stranger synchronicity will happen. Something that is so bizarre, so personal that I almost feel like it smacks me in the face and says, hey, pay attention. This is genuinely something of a higher order. This is not boring material existence. This is something more. And I hesitate to name it or label it in any way, but I have become comfortable with the term magical just because I think that word is apt. You know, it's giving some recognition to just how strange and how how far beyond the normal causality this goes.
I agree. I think the term magic is absolutely completely appropriate. Yeah. Or magical.
Yeah, yeah. I know that's a loaded term, but
who cares? But it's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's a question. How have you changed your life because of these things? Because of these magical events?
All right. As someone who's been doing this for a decade now, I've gone through waves. There was a point where I probably rode synchronicities like a wave and took everything as a sign, you know, oh, I guess I need to do this because this synchronicity is pointing the way. I've gone through that phase. I am out of that phase. all right. This isn't directly answering your question, but to say what I have learned is that, and you could go back and look at even early studies of this, Carl Jung and so on, synchronicities are very often, as you say, it's a reflection back, the universe reflecting back what you're projecting. So that means it doesn't necessarily always be a positive thing. It's not like, oh, here's, you know, when you hear like these sort of hippy-dippy, like, oh, I manifested this for myself, you know.
What they might have. They might have, yeah.
They totally might have. No, I know. But there's also some like negative synchronicities, for lack of a better term. There are terrifying synchronicities that occur from time to time. I don't think synchronicity is a negative force, but as you say, it's a reflection, and it's not always rainbows. And I do feel it's a common mistake to just kind of take everything as a, oh, this synchronicity happened, therefore I'm supposed to. You still have to keep your wits about you and keep your common sense about you. It's very easy to get caught up in these big mystical, what seem like these big mystical signs from the heavens. You know, you go back, you ever read the Iliad?
No, but I've seen the movie with Kirk Douglas.
Gotcha. Okay. You know, one of the oldest stories of Western culture, right? That story starts with what to me is fascinating is Zeus telling this guy, he gives him basically a precognitive dream that is intentionally misleading. He gives this guy a dream that says, hey, if you invade Troy right now, you will win and you will be like the coolest guy and everyone will love you and you're totally going to be successful. Knowing full well that he's setting this guy up for failure. He wants this guy to invade and then he's going to destroy him and all his people and everything. So it's presented as a mystical yet incorrect precognition. You know, it's bizarre in that way. Like you could fully have a vision from the gods. Doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. That's one of our oldest stories in the Western tradition. To me, there's a lesson in there somewhere. So I guess I'm, you know, 10 years out, I take synchronicities with a certain grain of salt. I'm no less awed by them, but I'm a little more reluctant to let them make decisions for me.
Yeah. So at this point, and I've talked about this in my writings and stuff, and I've repeated this over and over again, I see owls, UFOs, and synchronicities as essentially the same thing, right? I mean, so each one of those things has a power, right? Obviously, a synchronicity can be very powerful and people can change their lives because of it. And I feel like I totally went down the path and I let synchronicity be my compass for a long time, and it changed my life. Synchronicity is the direct result of where I am right now. I had a career path, I had this other life, and all of that crumbled, and I followed this synchronicity stuff. It has been, we talked about this a little bit earlier, it has been so rewarding in every way except financially, which is fine because I am amazed at the magical qualities of this life path that I'm on now. Now, you could be in an unhealthy place with any of those things, following any of those paths, whether UFOs or synchronicities and owls. I definitely feel like I went through, I'll say it, I went through an unhealthy chapter of my life where I was so wrapped up and so lost following these things that it took a toll on me and took a toll on my friendships and all kinds of things. But, you know, whatever. I mean, I went up to the crazy line. I stepped across it for a little while, and then you have to kind of back off and like reground yourself. And I just think I got bored of being that obsessed. So I obviously we need to step into the darkest part of the forest. At the same time, we also need to be grounded and be very self-aware that we're sharing. We still have to pay the rent and eat.
Absolutely, yeah. And I just want to, you know, I put that out there, but I want to back up and say, yes, as you said, look, synchronicity has been an incredibly positive and life-changing force in my life. I would not change it or trade it for anything in the world. I don't want to, as I said, I don't want to put a negative spin on it. I just want to say, yeah, I think there is you know, particularly maybe I actually listened to a lecture you did not too long ago, and you were talking about if you want proof of this, just look at my email inbox was an expression you used.
Yes, and I think that I mean I've it has been proven to me by the similarity of the stories. If nothing else, my email inbox has been a form of confirmation. Yeah.
Right. So here you are, you get out there and you say, hey, does anybody have any experiences with owls and synchronicities and UFOs? And people flood your email with these stories and you get a particular insight that most other people don't get. Well, like you, I got out there and was sort of on the stage of the internet and whatever this is and was talking about synchronicity, and I got a lot of emails, and that gives me an insight into where people are with it. And for me, it was a very positive thing and something I felt I had a healthy relationship with. And I realized through those emails, not everyone has that healthy relationship. For some people, this sort of melting of the fourth wall, this idea of like, huh, I'm thinking about something and then it appears in my day-to-day life is, yeah, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like a schizophrenic, you know, there's like a paranoid moment of like, what is this? It can be very, very frightening, and it can unhinge people from reality. So I have learned to be a lot more, again, from a financial standpoint, this is the worst business decision I ever made, but it makes me feel much more honest and able to sleep at the end of the night. I see people, you know, people I've worked with who turned their synchronicity research into this, and I, you know, sort of new agey love and light approach that synchronicity is wonderful and it's the universe is providing for you and it's all great and, you know, it's this path to enlightenment and all this sort of, you know, big smiling rainbow stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'm getting emails from people who aren't experiencing that. And I don't think it's fair to advertise this as that. I want some truth in advertising to say that it might lead you to, synchronicity is your innermost self projected outward, you will learn a lot about yourself. You will have amazing moments of introspection and about the world and the universe and your place in it. And it's incredibly uplifting at times. And just like any true spiritual or quasi psychedelic experience, it's also going to have big pitfalls and sand traps around the edges that we need to be aware of, and I think we need to, you know, sort of address at the outset. And that is, again, probably hurt my financial success in marketing synchronicity, but I can't talk about it any other way than to say, like, hey, let's be real, man. It's got its ups and its downs. It's what you bring with it. I say, like, a psychedelic experience, because it's so surreal at times. Even if you look at the earliest psychedelic research, like your Timothy Leary's and things like that, they used an expression that was called set and setting, which means literally your environment. If you were to take these psychedelics at your friend's house or in your own home or in the forest or where, you know, or you're at a club, those are all different settings. But then there's also your set, and set is what you bring to the experience. What psychological baggage? If you just got out of a breakup, or you just got fired from your job, or you're dealing with whatever it might be, you're bringing that into your psychedelic experience. You have that brain chatter going on. You might experience some negativity because of that. In a similar sort of way, synchronicities are, again, a projection of your inner state plus what's going on in the world, and neither of those things are always very tidy.
I hate to do this, but we are going to have to take our very first break. And for free Dreamlanders, you will hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Ever wonder what the Close Encounter experience is all about? Think you know what it's about? When you open Whitley and Ann Strieber's Immortal Communion Letters, you're going to experience a whole new vision. Not something being told to us by researchers and theorists, but the actual testimony of people who came face to face with this unknown. Unforgettable. And the book is only $3.99 at Strieber.com.
Say yes to serious wonder. Unknown Country offers so much. Free Dreamland, a free weekly newsletter, free daily news, a thriving free message board. But it all depends on you becoming a subscriber. And you get so much more. Dreamland and special interview archives going back years. Vintage Dreamland from the broadcast days. Live chats with our extraordinary guests. So say yes to serious wonder. Click on that subscribe tab on Unknown Country today.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world. Help keep us on the air by subscribing to unknowncountry.com today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Dreamland, where wonder is spoken.
We are back on The Unseen. I am with my friend Alan Abadasa-Green, and we are talking about synchronicity and synchromysticism. Just before the break, we were talking about, I guess, how the negative aspects to this. And I'll say straight up, like, you know, it is. I am very cautious to see the UFO lore, the UFO phenomena, the UFO contact experience painted only in glittering rainbows and such. Because, yes, there is kind of a love and light aspect to it, but there's a shadow side to it too. And then it's a mistake not to address both the dark and light sides of things. And honestly, in my research and what I've been looking at, it's weighted more towards the benevolent, it seems to be, but there's some dark stuff there. And I know a lot of people on the love and light side will deny the dark stuff. And I think that does a disservice to the people who are experiencing that, for one, and then just a complete understanding of the richness of the entirety of it.
Yeah, thank you. Well said. And again, my experience has been predominantly positive. So I share that experience with you of like that's the majority of my experiences have been positive, but there's no light that doesn't cast a shadow somewhere. And if we're going to fully explore any phenomenon or any aspect of ourselves or whatever it might be, I think it's important to look at all of the aspects, not just the ones that are friendly and very approachable.
Hey, I'm going to talk a little bit about a chapter in my recent book. Sure. The chapter is titled Synchromysticism. And, I did one chapter, which is something I know you and I both sort of latched onto this. And I did an essay in 2011 called The Evolutionary Triad. And it was comparing and contrasting Planet of the Apes to 2001. And we could spend 2 hours talking about all the disparate threads and how they're so tangled up. And that was at the point when I was reading a lot of these synchromystic websites, and I was thinking, you know, people are making these connections between pop culture and stuff. And I was like, well, how hard could that be? And I just kind of started doing this. And this thing just like poured in at me, all the strange connections between these two movies. What I do want to ask you real quick is you did a video where you actually overlapped these two movies, where you actually projected them, in essence, both movies on the same movie screen at the same time. And what was your goal in that, I guess?
This is so funny because I didn't tell you this, Mike, but probably 48 hours before you contacted me to do this interview, I started watching the original Outer Limits series, like for the first time, of like sit down with episode one and start watching it.
Oh, I have done that too. It is a joy. Anyone out there, it's on the internet. You can download it off of any number of sites. It's a beautiful, powerful thing to do. That series slays me. Okay, keep going.
Well, to say your Evolutionary Triad article was also included. It was 2001: A Space Odyssey, Planet of the Apes, and a specific episode of Outer Limits. So me sitting down to watch this was through that lens. I was literally thinking of you, of like, oh, I can't wait till I get to the episode that Mike talked about. So I thought that, and then within 48 hours, I got a message from you. So that's a perfect synchronicity right there.
And have you seen the episode?
No, not yet.
Ah, well, get ready. Get ready.
I'm ready for it. So to your point, so the majority of the article was about Planet of the Apes overlapping with 2001: A Space Odyssey. I have that conversation with you. We talk about it on a podcast, and I don't know. It wasn't that much longer. I had a dream where I saw the movies sort of overlapping. So if you could imagine, take like the first 5 minutes of Planet of the Apes, weigh that over the last 5 minutes of 2001, and then kind of keep repeating that. And it created an endless loop in my mind. And I experienced this in a dream. I saw it so clearly. And I was like, oh, I have to do that as an editing project. And I did it, and it works shockingly well. The plot lines are literally sort of the, you know, where 2001: A Space Odyssey starts with apes. Okay, we watch these apes, and then we take them out into space, and then suddenly there's a spaceship crashing. As you mentioned, it is the exact same filming location. They use Lake Powell in Utah. So they show the spaceship coming out of a stargate, crashing into Lake Powell in Utah. And then you look at Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Apes actually starts with Charlton Heston out in space, and they're on their spaceship, and he's talking, and he goes through a stargate, and then suddenly they crash into Lake Powell in Utah, and he's on this planet with the apes. And it's I have an abbreviated version. I did render off on my own computer. I have some, you know, like 6 hour video that I have no real way of sharing with the public, but where you could watch the whole film straight through. what I released for the public is a sort of abbreviated version. Like, we've all seen Planet of the Apes. We don't have to – I just sort of have, like, highlights. So I edited Planet of the Apes down to, like, 20 minutes and edited 2001 A Space Odyssey down to, like, 20 minutes and just showed the sort of overlapping of how this works. And it's pretty incredible. Also pretty telling, those movies were released the same day.
Three days apart.
Well, okay, yeah, it's really how you want to look at that, because there was a premiere, yeah, there's...
Can you tell me, was there a premiere that actually lines up?
Well, so if you, I think it's Space Odyssey, I should look it up, but just of my memory says Space Odyssey has like a premiere in like New York or DC or maybe London, I don't know, like 2 days before. And then it's like theatrical release. It's like these big city premieres, then sort of theatrical release. And then Planet of the Apes, I believe, just has the theatrical release is the one that's April 3rd. I should just look these dates up just so I'm not. But it's something like that. It's very, if it's not that, it's very close. So the safest way to say that is, yes, they came out the same week. They have the same filming location, these very specific cinematic elements, everything from humans dressed up like monkeys to spaceships and stargates and Lake Powell and all these weird things.
And a huge emphasis on evolution.
Absolutely. And you made the point that there is this, and it really, I look at Planet of the Apes differently after talking to you, this sequence where he finds the little baby doll. It really is the turning point of the story. Like, I think watching the movie, it didn't have quite the punch. I'd seen the movie a million times, and I realized after talking to you, it's like, oh no, it's literally like he picks up the doll speaks, and that is the moment in which the whole illusion is shattered.
Oh, just heads up, I just totally got the chills just now, like full body tingles. Keep going.
Yeah, it's in the film, that baby doll crying, or I think it says like mama or something, that the doll speaking is the smoking gun evidence for Charlton Heston to say, look, this human race that spoke existed before the apes, you know, and it's the thing that then Dr. Zaius ultimately freaks out about and, you know, attacks them over. It really is the turning point. It's a very subtle but major moment in the film. And then you talk about how that child is mirrored with the famous space baby at the end of 2001. You can really overlay these different events if you just sort of, as I said, you would sort of take the, you know, last few minutes of one film and the first few minutes of another. If you go to thesyncbook.com, I believe I actually have it. If you just Google Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O, space sync, S-Y-N-C, space book, you will get my Vimeo channel there with a bunch of videos that you can watch. I got a ton of cool stuff there. And one of which is a film, it says 2001, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And again, that's this edit that I'm talking about. And you can watch for yourself how those films overlap, really specific, weird references to each other in a way that, again, is this causality, is this synchronicity? What is it? I'm not quite sure, but.
And you know what I think? There is a power to the creative process, right? I mean, I feel like and I'm an artist and I should have a good understanding of what that means, but I don't. I mean, I think that there is a point of inspiration. There are these ideas and these memes and these thoughts and these powerful things that just kind of float out there. And then the artist, whether that be the script writer or the novelist or the filmmaker. These things, they pick these out of the collective subconscious, and they get plugged in. So in a sense, it's not magic if the subconscious cloud that surrounds us is real, but it certainly appears as magic.
Absolutely, yeah. And that appearance, that sense of awe, is the thing that even after 10 years, I can't shake. It still impresses me.
And it impresses me too. Hey, we are going to have to take our second and final break here, and we will return very shortly for free Dreamlanders. You're going to hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
You think that what subscribers to UnknownCountry.com get is just an archive or a rehash of what you can hear for free? Not quite true. Listen to this.
The Indonesian doctor is writing an article in the 1980s. This is more than 10 years after the mysterious German doctor has died. And now he's writing his recollections of that whole episode. And one of his recollections was that there was a small boy at one time when he first met the doctor in the island of Sumbawa. There was a small American boy living with him.
And that small American boy may very well have been the son of the mysterious doctor that Peter LaVenda is talking about. A special interview called Adolf Hitler in Asia. That boy went on to grow up, to come to the United States, to become a horrendous anti-Semite and serial killer. He was executed in Indiana in 2010. I'm telling you, you don't hear this anywhere else. Nowhere else. So come on, get on the stick. Become a subscriber to UnknownCountry.com. I guarantee you there is incredible information in our subscriber area, and we need you to keep supporting this. It's important. There's no place like it. No other website offers you the amazing riches of unusual and extraordinary information that we do. Subscribe today.
Ever wonder which Whitley Strieber books are available and where you can get them? Now you can go to Whitley Strieber's dedicated book website, Strieber.com, and shop for every Whitley Strieber item that's available. Many of them are available in electronic form, as well as hardcover and paperback. Experience the magic of transformation, the insights of breakthrough, the joy of miraculous journey. Join Whitley on the wondrous journey of that is his life. Thrill to his fiction, the magic of Orenda, the startling power of Alien Hunter, and so much more. Go to Strieber.com now and explore.
We are back on The Unseen, and I am here with my friend Alan Apodaca Green. We are talking about synchronicities and the synchromystical. Just before the break, we talked about Planet of the Apes in 2001. I want to talk about a story which you don't know, and I'm going to fill you in a little bit on this, and I just want to get your feedback on it. This was a blog post that I did in 2012, and this was right after the Aurora shooting. So this is a dark story. The Aurora, Colorado theater shooting when they were playing one of the Batman movies at midnight. A bunch of people were killed in the theater. One of the people that got killed was a young woman named Jessica Redfield, and she was a sports reporter for Fox News. And it wasn't her real name, but she chose the name Redfield. Her real name is Guai, and it was just hard to pronounce, so she changed her name to Redfield for this. And following her story, there were so many strange synchronicities. So this woman, Jessica Redfield, was involved peripherally in a mass shooting that took place about 40 days earlier in Toronto, Canada. And she wrote a blog post. She has a blog, I think it's still online. It has only two articles. One, she was a sports reporter. She wrote an article about hockey. And the other one was titled Late Night Thoughts on the Eaton Center Shooting by Jessica Redfield, June 5th, 2012. And it starts out, I can't get this odd feeling out of my chest, this empty, almost sickening feeling that won't go away. And she talks about how this was right after the event, and she had been in the food court, and then she had this feeling, like this, like almost like panicky feeling, I got to get out of here. And so she left the food court, and as she walked out, she heard gunfire. And that was where the attack took place, was several people died in this food court. A man just came in and opened fire with a rifle. Now, mainstream news picked up on this, that this woman, Jessica Redfield, had this blog post, and everyone, mainstream news, they all pointed out the unsettling coincidence to this. Now, there was so much stuff, just the color red plays out over and over again. She changed her name to Redfield. The gunman at the Aurora event had dyed his hair bright red. And then there's a bunch that goes on. I won't go into all of it, but several days before the event, she went to an organized tomato fight in Denver where she was living. And so it was basically a big truck full of like overripened tomatoes was dropped off at this parking lot, and all these people had a fight and they threw tomatoes at each other. And there are pictures of her from just a few days before the event, and she is splattered with bright red tomato glop. And she writes, and these were posted on her Twitter page, and I grabbed them from the Twitter page. And she wrote, "To those wishing they were there, tomatoes were rotten. I threw up multiple times. The smell was vile and damp, and so was the texture." And there's these pictures that you cannot look at without the weight of premonition. Just, it is brutal. And one particularly horrible picture where she looks miserable and she's splattered and she's got a white tank top on and it's just splattered with this red glop. She looks miserable. And that photo on her Twitter feed was posted at 3:33 p.m. Now, I say in the article, I am so cautious. This is a real person. This is a real event. But the weight of this event and all the subtle coincidences and some not so subtle, some incredibly overt, like she got up and left the site of mass shooting 42 days earlier. I can't separate the heavy human experience from these coincidences.
No, this to me is an important lesson. You made a comment earlier that you said there was a point where you went through a dark phase where you were so obsessed with the owl thing that you sort of felt like you lost touch with some friends and things. I went through a point where I was, if you study any synchronicity from a clinical psychology point of view, you get these ideas of like archetypes, right? These like archetypal figures. And it was really important for me of like the lesson of like, oh, these, I'm starting to look at like my friends and family as archetypes, which is healthy in one perspective from like a realizing what role they play in my life, but not healthy in the sense of like dehumanizing them and forgetting that they make my life fulfilling. There's a reason they are my friends. And all this sort of stuff, it's really common when we're studying these phenomena online to forget that we're talking about people, that are these tragic events take a toll on someone, and that the person feeling that terror of that premonition to remember or acknowledge what they felt. And I think that is a really hard part, but an important part of this study, is to remind ourselves that these are real people. And in a way, as you say, it adds a weight to these experiences. It's a shame. You know, the most recent video I did is exploring 9/11 synchronicities, going back, and that those have, you know, in some respect, they are the things that kind of got me interested in this in the first place. They're also the thing that I kind of come back to a lot. In a way, I almost feel like they've been discussed so much. But I found these few things. I'm like, oh, no one's ever talked about this. I really want to address these points. And every time I go back to this event, that to me is so full of synchronicities, it's hard to step into that headspace and not be hit by the reality of these are tragic events. These are, in a way, it almost feels like they are more synchronistically powerful. This is just pure like speculation or like a kind of a gut intuition, but if it's something that people are going to agonize over and put a ton of emotion into, multiple people are going to be feeling very strong emotions around this one specific event, it almost feels like that adds to the power of the synchronicity.
I know exactly what you mean, where there's like, you know, there was the synchromystics, especially in the 2009 to about 2012 or so, there were tons of videos that were totally fun, and they would kind of connect these things with movies, and there was a super fun, playful aspect to it. This, writing this article about Jessica Redfield, did not feel fun at all. It felt like the weight of the world was on me as I was writing it, and I was aware of that. And I think there are events that are like flypaper. There's something about a powerful human experience or experience of humanity, because this wasn't just one person. This touched thousands of people, as did 9/11, as did the JFK assassination, as did the Gabrielle Giffords shooting. These events are loaded with synchronicities. And there are some people that will stand to the side and say, oh, this shows that the Illuminati is like, has some master plan and they've orchestrated all this stuff. And I don't buy that.
Nor do I.
I could say that, yes, so something happened. What I'm saying is that these highly charged human events or highly charged events in history bring with them an inherent power that is like glue to these synchronicities. It attracts them. And things stick to them in a way that boggle my mind. And I am at a loss to fully define it, but I sense it. It's there.
It's very, very well said. I've experienced the same thing. I've noticed it over and over. I admit I have a certain reluctance when I will see sometimes like when a tragic event happens. You know, you see like whoever you know that's into like the more conspiratorial side, they're going to be like, oh, this is a false flag shooting or whatever. And then you have, I know a lot of synchronicity people who are going to be like, oh, let's look at the weird symbolic aspects of this. I'm always so hesitant to touch these tragic events and turn them into, you know, some, I don't know, commodify them or to feel like I'm addressing them without any kind of respect. I don't know, there's definitely weird emotions around that for me. But I would be lying if I didn't say I completely feel the weight and pull of these events as attractors. And really strong examples, like you and I have been talking about synchronicity for an hour. We've given just maybe a handful of like little examples. But when you actually dive into any of these events and can start to literally write down, say, hey, this happened and this happened and this happened. And isn't it crazy that this woman experienced this? Again, if this is we go into some conspiratorial territory with that Aurora shooting, I know there are people who think that's like a staged event or something like that. But when you have these synchronicities in your own life, when you study this phenomenon and really have a catalog of experiences that are inexplicable to fall back on and to sort of color your opinion of these events, it suddenly becomes a lot more plausible that it's a real woman who actually experienced this precognition and ran out of a food court than that she's a you know, like a, what do they call it, a crisis actor or something like that. I think it's much more likely, and because I've had those experiences, I could just think we remember being in a car. I got, it was in a car accident back in 2007 or 8, and being in the car and literally like jump, like jerking my head up. I was like starting to fall asleep and jerking my head, and like, we're about to get into a car accident. And like within 30 seconds, that car flipped over. Like it was, we were in snow. I jerked my head up, was like fully aware, like we're about to get into a car accident. And then the driver hit a patch of ice. We hit the median and flipped the truck over. But I was like 30 seconds before, like I knew that was coming.
And in my owl stuff, I cannot tell you how many owl stories I have where people will say they were driving down the road. An owl was either standing in the road and made them slow down and had to turn around, or an owl flew in front of them and they put their brakes on. And then moments later, there was an event where there was a car accident just in front of them. And if they had not slowed down because of the owl, they would have been in the accident.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That is surprisingly normal. So the owl is the premonition. The owl is the event. The owl is the thing that says, oh my gosh, I gotta leave the Eaton food court. It's not a gut feeling. So yeah, so this is so tangled up in my head, and I have a very difficult time separating the source of these things. All I know is that there is a source out there.
Yeah, and the owl, I love that you've really zeroed in on the owl as the messenger of, it's whether or not they are the ones providing these events, or is just a symbol of that phenomenon as a whole. That's a much bigger conversation, but certainly that they are symbolic of the message from some sort of bigger source, that larger mirror that we've just been discussing.
Hey, let's jump back to October of 2013. Now, there's a long, complicated story that you play a pivotal role in. You had no idea about any of this leading up to it. I had been involved with all these owl synchronicities that involved, at one point, me trying to talk to someone. I had to run back and forth to do my laundry. At the time I was living, my next door neighbor had a washing machine that I would use, and so I'd run back and forth and do my laundry at my neighbor's house. So in the midst of all these owl synchronicities, I was doing my laundry. And on Wednesday, October 2nd, 2013, you were driving home from the laundromat. And do you tell me what happened?
I have to imagine what this is. I was living in North Carolina at the time, and I was driving home from the laundromat. And as we're pulling onto the street, I suddenly get this sort of, like, I don't know, like a weird like voice in my head being like, owls, Mike, owls. So I was thinking about you and owls, and it was just like suddenly this like loud thought in my mind. And we pull into the driveway, and there is an owl sitting in my driveway. I think I took a picture and sent it to you, but it was like literally seeing the physical owl was preceded by a full, you know, 45 seconds, 30 seconds by this thought of you and owls, and like just very, very loud. Like it felt very important in the moment of like, you know, Mike, owls.
Now, that's not a synchronicity. That's a psychic premonition. So that's outside the boundaries of synchronicity. That's something else entirely. But it was interwoven with so much stuff, other stuff with owls. And in quite literally that same day, someone had sent me an image, which I put side by side on the blog. And I think it's side by side in both the book format and in the ebook format, of the two owl photographs. The one you took and then the one that one sent me in the same morning, where it was an owl in the driveway. They were, I don't want to say, it's obviously not near identical, but it was basically a close-up shot of an owl staring up at the cameraman in a driveway, both pictures.
Yeah, that's so. Here's another synchronicity I had with you not too long ago. As I said, I listened to a lecture of yours. It was like 2 months back. I was driving. Funny enough, I had gone down to North Carolina, not the same part of North Carolina, but it was in North Carolina. I was driving back and was listening to a lecture of yours while driving. And I get out of the car. I had to drive actually straight to work. And I was working at this rooftop bar. It was, you know, when the weather was nice, with this beautiful rooftop space, and go straight to work and just jump in. And I'm working this bar. And there comes a point where suddenly, like, everyone's like, grab me, like, oh my God, look at that. Look up in the sky. What is that? And it was these, like, weird glowing lights in the sky. Turned out to be some sort of, like, parachuting guys doing some sort of, like, aerial show or something. But totally out of the ordinary. No one knew what it was. And so what do I be thinking about you, have been listening to this conversation and sort of thinking in these terms, and then showing up at work and with people grabbing like, look up in the sky. What is that? What are those lights? And it was just a really funny experience for me.
And that's the core of the best synchronicities, those when they have that little twinkle in them, you know, that playful aspect to it.
No, oh, yeah. And, you know, at this point, it's like I experience this so regularly. You know, and some that are, again, like, I feel like there's a scale. Those are the ones that are, like, fun to laugh at and say, like, it's playful. And some that are just so damn bizarre. I'm going to tell you a real quick story that's sort of, there's no context for this, but I was, I'm living in Richmond, Virginia now. When I moved here a few years ago, I was working this bar, and this girl that I was working with was kept saying how much she thought I looked like, what is his name? Oh, Jason Schwartzman. She kept saying, oh, you look so much like Jason Schwartzman. So came time for Halloween, and she said, you should dress up as a Jason Schwartzman character. I said, sure, you pick the cat. Like, I'll do it. Just, you know, pick a character, whatever. So we end up, you know, doing that for that Halloween. I did a character from one of his movies, and she did another character from that movie.
Oh, what movie?
Scott Pilgrim.
I knew it. Good. Very good.
Yeah.
Didn't he have a cane in that?
He had like a white jacket and a red shirt, glasses, and side. Like I grew out a beard and shaved it, so I'd have like the sideburns.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, good. Okay, I'm glad. Yeah, that's exactly what I pictured when you said you dressed up like him. Good.
So, and then she dressed up as the Ramona character from the movie. And so, like, we worked the whole night like that. And it was, you know, it was fun, whatever. So that's Halloween. About, like, 2 weeks later, so I'm hanging out with this woman. And I end up meeting her roommate and kind of hitting it off somewhat romantically. And I very briefly end up dating this girl's roommate. So I go over to the house one night, and she's talking about, bear in mind, this is the roommate of the girl who was like, oh my God, you look like Jason Schwartzman, you have to do this costume. So she says, oh, something about Jason Schwartzman, and have you ever seen this show? The show is kind of this like noir murder mystery comedy. I apologize. I can't think. It was a short-lived TV show. And she's like, oh, you've really never seen this? And I'm like, no. And she's like, cool. Well, I'm just going to like put on an episode. But she was like jumping in the shower or something. So she's like, here, you know, I'm going to put this episode on. You should really watch this show. So here I am sitting down to watch this show about this guy that I'm supposed to look like. And what happens in this episode, the series takes place in Manhattan, so I grew up in Queens, New York, and in this episode, he ends up going to Queens, and my jaw drops. Like, they're shooting the scene in like this back alley behind this like restaurant or whatever. This is literally one block from where the house that I grew up in. Like, this is the alley where I would go and play in as a kid. Like, I knew, oh my God, I know this alleyway. It's so specific to my experience, my childhood experience. And I'm like, why are they filming this man that you're telling me, like, hey, look, doesn't this guy look like you? And literally there's this non sequitur scene of this guy like running through this alleyway that I spent so much time as a child in. And it's just one of those things. And, you know, so she comes out of the shower and I'm trying to, she's like, so what'd you think? Wasn't it a funny show? And I'm like trying to explain this thing. And she's like, she wanted to be like, isn't it funny? And I'm like, no, this isn't funny. This is a really weird synchronicity for me. And I don't know, like, I don't know what that, like, that to me, those moments of where it's a synchronicity, but then it is overlapping with media. You know, we mention how synchromystics will very often sort of talk about finding coincidences in media, looking at movies, and there are sometimes great examples of almost like a shared dream. I can point, it's a repeatable synchronicity. You know, if I tell you a story of, oh, weirdest thing happened to me at the supermarket, then it's just this sort of abstract. But if I can point to a scene in a movie and be like, look, you can literally see this man, and we can rewind and play it back and forward. There are times where media is great for those kind of examples. And this, for me, was this thing that was a media synchronicity, but so personal that no one else would have gotten that experience out of that scene but me. But it was just so loud when it happened. And this was, you know, a few years ago now. And just in the last week, I've been thinking about that one a bunch.
I will add that, like, the UFO thing plays out like that too. And I just spoke with a Bigfoot researcher. His name is Timothy Renner. And he said the same thing. These Bigfoot experiences play out with a personal quality that is intended and focused and orchestrated for the one person observing it, or for the one person experiencing it. This is interwoven into the mystery in ways that baffle me.
And it's probably the thing that keeps us all coming back to our, you know, whatever your chosen entry point to this mystery is, whether that's owls, Bigfoot, UFO, synchronicity, any of these things, these are literally entry points to this giant question mark, this big mystery. And I think it's the really personal aspect that just keeps drawing us back to it day after day.
I agree. So you said the dream, like the collective dream, or like the shared dream. I have gotten to the point now where I'm looking at reality as if it were a dream. I am looking at reality and analyzing reality, and I am using the tools of someone who does dream analysis to try to better understand reality itself. I'll give you just one simple example. So first off, you and I have gone into a cave together. And I just think the cave is like the perfect, that's a metaphoric symbolic element of going into the unknown, going into the depths, going into the underworld, going into the shadow world. I don't know if we talked about it at the time, but I just looked at some pictures of us, and there we were in a cave. Go on.
I think back to that that experience with you very, very often. I know for you that was essentially your backyard, where you were living at the time. You were so close to the Teton National Park there, but that was really powerful for me, and it did feel both, you know, like symbolic, like this metaphorical layer was definitely stretched over all of that experience.
And I didn't think about it until just now. As I was preparing for this, I went back and looked at our, you know, some old emails and stuff like that. But the reality as a dream. Now, just here's a little example, and this gets blurry too, because what's the fabric of reality when you get down to this? There's a recent movie called Witness of Another World, and it is a beautiful movie, and it is about an event that took place when a fellow Juan in South America as a boy had a UFO experience, and the movie follows him now through his adulthood. It's an amazing, beautiful thing. But in the story, it's not an abduction story. He's riding his horse, doing farm work, doing ranch work, and he comes upon what amounts to a landed flying saucer. And he gets off his horse, and he climbs up a ladder into the flying saucer. Now, I don't know, flying saucer, do they need ladders? I don't know. I mean, but so the ladder, to me, is dream imagery. the ladder is liminal, right? You are leaving one place and you're entering another place. That ladder is the liminal middle ground, the threshold between the two. So when I heard that story, I was just like, oh, that's the most important part of the whole thing. It's the ladder. So I'm at the point now, for better or for worse, where I'm seeing this symbolic imagery welling up all around me, this dream imagery welling up around me, or in stories that people share with me.
And it's a beautiful way. Again, you know, we need a sort of working model, a lens that we can put over these experiences, so we have a way just to enter the territory and have a conversation around it. And the dream analogy, while it has, you know, pretty heavy implications, it's sort of overlaps with like that simulation sort of Philip K. Dick matrix like thing. It's the idea that this is somehow, it's reality, but it's not real. It has some pretty heavy implications, but the dream metaphor, or maybe not a metaphor, might be true, is one that works really well, because it not only kind of explains things, but it gives you an approach that we talk about, like lucid dreaming or this sort of hypnagogic states and things like that, where we can feel how, again, you know, we know what our day-to-day material existence is. We know that that's an inescapable aspect of this, but there's this strange elasticity. There's this strange seepage or distortion of those rules from time to time, and it's so surreal that that model works surprisingly well. And I go back to, you and I discussed when I was on your podcast, you said it was, did you say 9 years ago?
9 years ago, yeah.
We talked about this dream I had with David Bowie and all these precognition about winning lottery numbers and things like that. I think we told that story on that podcast. I'm thinking back to David Bowie in Twin Peaks. What is his lesson that he learns from entering that White Lodge, that hypnagogic place, that middle ground space? And he says, we live inside a dream. And I'm just hearing that voice, that line play over, and it feels, some days it just feels really, really strong. Like that's the best metaphor, the best lens, the best model to approach this. And I sympathize with that immensely.
As do I. I hate to say this. We're going to have to bring this to an end. This has been a delight, and I have missed talking to you. We need to talk more often. And how do people get in touch with you?
I've started releasing some new content on my website that's been around for, you go to thesyncbook.com, thesyncbook, thesyncbook.com. I've got archives there going back years. We have some interviews with you, Mike. There's a search function if someone wants to find old episodes. I've got videos and podcasts and books and tons of stuff going back over the last 10 years or so. And I've just started releasing a new video series called Hindsight 2020, trying to go back and look at retrace some of the things that we've already talked about, but with the context of having this additional decade and realizing stuff that, while we were in the midst of it, seemed like, wow, this is a weird thing that's happening. We were able to catalog some of these synchronicities. You give another 10 years of context, you're able to place it in a moment in history, see what else is going on around it, and it's even weirder and more revealing than it was at the moment. So I'm trying to kind of play with some of that stuff right now, and that is the featured video. If you go to thesyncbook.com, there's a video right at the very top. It's like a 20-minute little mini documentary, and that's the first episode of that. I'd appreciate anyone wanting to give that a view and let me know what they think.
Alan, this has been a delight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I was really, really good talking to you, man. Thank you.
Hi, this is Mike. I am chiming in at the end after the editing here. I wanted to check in and say that this was a wonderful talk for me, and it felt like it drifted more into the realm of conversation and sort of drifted out of the realm of a formal interview, which I like a lot. So it felt like you, the listener, got to sort of eavesdrop on the type of conversations I have had over the years with Alan. I would like to take this moment to thank Lauren Cutts for the intro and outro music, and Andrea Lissette Villiers on the gong. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.